The Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio is now in open session pursuant to adjournment.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Our first case this morning is 2020-191, State Ex Rel Ohio History Connection versus the Mound Builders Country Club Company. For the appellate, Mr. Fraley.
Chief Justice O'Connor, and may it please the court. How much power does the government have to claim ownership over private property? That's the question before the court this morning. The Ohio General Assembly has adopted an eminent domain system, which is designed to ensure that Ohio landowners are treated fairly when the awesome power of the government is used. The stated intention of the General Assembly is set forth in Ohio Revised Code 163.59. In part, it is to encourage and expedite the acquisition of property by agreements with owners. It's to avoid litigation and relieve congestion in the courts and encourage a consistent treatment for the owners. It's also to promote public confidence in the acquisition practices. None of these stated policies were adhered to by the Ohio History Connection in this case. As we know, to achieve jurisdiction in this case, they shall provide a written offer, good faith offer to the owner. The lower courts applied a definition of good faith as being the absence of bad faith. They further went on to discuss engaging in a conscious wrongdoing or a dishonest purpose. Both of the lower courts applied the wrong standard. Bad faith is not found in the statute. The lower court failed to support any of its ruling with cases that discuss good faith within the concept of a statutory definition.
Counsel, isn't good faith defined in the statute?
Justice, it is defined only as it applies to the word good faith. It is further defined in by this court in other cases, not particularly within this statute, both other statutes talking about good faith within a statutory definition.
Are we bound by the statutory definition?
I believe we are bound. There is a strict construction, as you know, in all eminent domain cases as it applies to statutory definitions. Good faith in this particular case, the court decided that in the absence of bad faith, good faith was achieved. Now, this court in both Kalin versus Smith and also Worth versus Huntington Bank Shares gave us some indication of good faith when applied in a statutory concept. The court went on to say that in Kalin, for example, that a party may have failed to make a good faith effort to settle even when it has not acted in bad faith. They promulgated a four-part test, part two of which is important in this case. Number two indicated that they must have rationally evaluated the risks and evaluated potential liability. Worth versus Huntington Bank Shares then goes further than that. Basically indicates that in some cases, a lack of good faith is synonymous with bad faith. However, that is not true in all situations, as the court declared. Moreover, in all cases of good faith, the court said in their ruling that a good faith determination must be informed. Now apply that to the case at bar. The OHC CEO testified. He was not an appraiser. He did not know what a least fee value was or know technically to what that even referred to. He then went on to say that he never sought guidance from legal counsel or any other expert to help him understand the appraisals he was reviewing. Please keep in mind that both appraisals were addressed to a seasoned attorney from one of the biggest law firms in this state. Nevertheless, the CEO indicated he did not avail himself of that attorney to find out what these meant. So if we take the two cases that were mentioned previously, He did not rationally evaluate the appraisals, nor was he reasonably informed of the appraisals.
So, Counselor, let me interrupt you here. So you're stating this argument to prove that there was not a good faith offer, correct?
That is correct.
So if we find that there was not, then what happens?
Very good question. The jurisdiction question has to be answered before the court can go any further. Jurisdiction is based on a written good faith offer. If it is found by this court that the OHC did not make a good faith offer, anything after that, the court lacked jurisdiction to hear anything else.
Okay,
how do you reconcile that with our case law, like the Ruhlman decision, for example, which says that subject matter jurisdiction essentially says that these things aren't subject matter jurisdiction?
Well, I believe even in subject matter jurisdiction, if the wrong standard is used, and keep in mind, Justice, that in this case, the court found a lack of bad faith.
But that doesn't go to the authority of a court, a tribunal, to hear the case. I mean, that seems to be a requirement to appropriate the property, but that doesn't seem a jurisdictional requirement.
Well, it under 163.05, it states an agency that has met the requirements of the section of 163.04 and 163.04.1 of the Higher Revised Code may commence proceedings in a court by filing a petition of appropriation. So without that jurisdictional piece, which starts with the toll for accessing yourself to the court system is by virtue of making that good faith offer, which then vests the court in the ability.
Doesn't jurisdiction go to the power of the court, not the parties?
Well, again, if the jurisdiction requirement that a good faith offer is made, it would seem that that is the first analysis the court must discuss and figure out where they stand on that position. In this particular case, the wrong standard was used. And therefore, we believe that jurisdiction is not appropriate if, as the previous justice indicated, if there is finding that good faith was not obtained in this case.
Isn't this really subject to an abuse of discretion? I mean, some of the case law you cited said that good faith analysis is generally within the sound discretion of the trial court. It's the Killeen case at page 159. So I did you make this argument about jurisdiction in the courts below?
Oh, we did, Your Honor. And understand that jurisdiction is an argument that never can be waived, but it was made. And it was made in this way. If the court used the wrong standard to decide the good faith, which again is the toll to get on the jurisdiction road, if they misapplied the standard of good faith, then how is it that anything after that could be found within their jurisdiction?
How is the Court of Appeals in error in not finding an abuse of discretion of the trial court? Because the trial court generally has the sound discretion to make that good faith determination.
Yes, the court erred in basically this way. They essentially parroted the wrong standard for good faith. The appellate court said in their ruling that a lack of bad faith equated to good faith. This also goes back, I think, much into the Norwood case that is very controlling on all eminent domain cases, where a strict construction must be used. If bad faith doesn't show up in the statute, and then the court uses bad faith, which they may have that ability to do so. But if the standard is good faith equates to lack of bad faith, that's not consistent with what this court has said in Kalin versus Smith and Worth versus Huntington Bankshares.
Okay, Counsel, OHC had two appraisals in this case, right?
That is correct.
Okay, let's assume that they only had the Kuhn appraisal for the $800,000 and they made that offer. Would that have been a good faith offer?
Well, thank you for that. It would, and here's why. As stated in 163.59, the intention of the General Assembly is stated. So how would that comport? One, if there was just one appraisal, the Kuhn appraisal, they would have submitted that. They relied upon it. That's appropriate. If they did two or three or five, which a state agency would certainly be able to do, leaving the landowner at a distinct disadvantage. So when you do two, by the way, the statute contemplates an appraisal. That grammatical part of the statute is covered in Purdue, and specifically means singular. If you look at a strict construction of this case and construing the Ohio Revised Code, when they say and by any definition grammatically, and refers to one, how can we now say that two, three, five, 10 appraisals would be appropriate? Now let's go back to what the General Assembly intended in that case. They wanted to promote public confidence in an eminent domain taking. They wanted to be fair to the landowner, eminent domain taking. They also wanted to avoid litigation. How would this avoid litigation? If they're allowed, if this court says it's okay to do two, three, five, 10 appraisals, but only supply one to the party, wouldn't you have to file in court every single case to find out if that was done? In other words, wouldn't it behoove and wouldn't it be a requirement of the party that the land is being taken from to file that case in court? If they do not, they have no ability, because of the statute, to conduct discovery to get the other appraisals. Now, how can that be just and within keeping of 163.59? It can't be. It can't be reconciled in that situation. So, two problems.
So there were two appraisals. One of the appraisals, the amount was misunderstood. Am I correct on that by the CEO?
The testimony before the trial court was that he did not understand, but more importantly, did no due diligence in trying to understand.
You already made that point.
Yes.
The statute doesn't say you have to take the highest appraisal. It doesn't, because you just argued that it anticipates only one appraisal. So even under the mistaken impression, they did offer the highest appraisal. In other words, they did base their offer on the highest appraisal. And do you have any dispute that the entity that did the appraisal was not qualified to do an appraisal?
I do not have any dispute along those lines, Justice O'Connor. But I would add that in looking at that appraisal, and if we use some of the other case law already cited, they would have had to have made an informed, rational decision. There can be no argument that that was done in this case. There was not an informed, rational decision.
Thus, what are you asking us to write? What is it that you're asking us to write? So when a government entity is engaged in an eminent domain matter and has more than one appraisal, finish that. What is it you want us to write?
We believe that that should be clear, that a rational, informed decision must be made and due diligence is required when this situation would occur. Now, again, let me go back and
counsel, isn't the forum for determining the accuracy of the appraisal, the court? You can take that, to the court. You can show that the appraisal was inadequate or undervalued. You can then dispute that and present evidence in court, and a determination on the appraisal is then being made. So why is that fatal here? Because you say that it was an uninformed appraisal, which I would think you're saying it was too low. I don't know, but the forum, you don't start out by saying we're going to, because we don't like the value amount or the process on how they arrived at it, even though it wasn't a certified appraiser. You're premature on that, aren't you?
I don't believe so, and here's why. In order to vest jurisdiction, the good faith offer must be made. If you look at 163.59 and the intention of the statute, Justice, the statute is set up to provide confidence with the public, avoid litigation, promote the ability to acquire land by agreement. All of those are stated intentions of the statute. If this statute is strictly construed, as this court has clearly said it should be, then how, under the conditions that you just stated, if they do not allow us to look at that appraisal during that process, they essentially, we did not know there was another appraisal. So this is not about how much the appraisal was or whether the appraiser.
Counselor, are you saying your clients didn't do an appraisal themselves?
Of course we did after jurisdiction was vested in the court. But that does not speak to whether a good faith offer was made. I certainly understand where you're going, that in a valuation trial, maybe all the appraisals get thrown in. But is that in keeping with the stated intention of the statute?
Well, how the time has run out. I want you to go to the second proposition of law and tell me about necessary.
Thank you. The court again used a determination of necessary that as long as it was for a public use, then that part of the statute was met. The problem with that is in the case of Norwood, the court clearly set out a situation, a test that public use has to be a flexible doctrine. It also doesn't put any minimal standard in that case of public use, that it's clear, and actually page 36 of the Norwood decision, I think is very clearly put. The court must determine whether it is sufficient for public use and benefit in a taking. The standard that was used in the lower courts was not that. It was only, was it for a public use? They answered that question, yes. It is our belief that you have to go further than that, weigh the public interest as contemplated in Norwood. That was not done. Once that question was answered, Justice, that this was for a public use. Keep in mind the public use. The OHC believes that the authority of 149.30 gives them the right to create a public park. It does not. There is nothing in that statute that indicates they have the right to create a public park. Now, given that that statute has to be construed strictly, how can we then get to a public use without any analysis as to whether that's good for the public, whether it's in the public interest as contemplated by Norwood? And when you start with the definition that enables the Ohio History Connection, which does not give it the ability to create a public park, that is their stated intention. Now, why did they do that then? One simple reason. This is and has always been about getting into World Heritage Foundation. We know from Norwood that is speculative. The World Heritage Foundation, the last rounds, there's been 3 out of 5 nominations that have been accepted in the United States. So we know under Norwood that would be speculative as to whether they would get in. So they conveniently switched the argument to, we want this for a public park. Now, if 149.30 enabled that might be a much better argument, but it does not. The closest I could find was that it is enabling for a monument. So this would be a 125-acre monument that they seek to do. They don't say that. They say that this is for use as a public park. Therefore, necessity requirement is met. Without any analysis.
Thank you. Your time is up.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Peterson.
Thank you, Your Honor. Chief Justice O'Connor, and may it please the court. This case is not about whether the country club is owed compensation or the amount of compensation that the country club is owed. Instead, it is first about whether the Ohio History Connection properly initiated the eminent domain process And second, whether the appropriation at issue in this case is necessary for a public purpose. Namely,
if the Ohio History Connection did not appropriately initiate the process, what does that mean? Is that jurisdictional? Does the court have no jurisdiction?
I don't think it is jurisdictional, Justice DeWine, for the same reasons that you were articulating earlier. As this court has made clear more recently, while the term jurisdiction has oft been abused in the past, has been more careful more recently, say the jurisdiction, subject matter jurisdiction, goes to the power of a court. And no one disputes that a court here has the power, the trial court had the power to hear this eminent domain proceeding. And if you look to Revised Code Chapter 163, there are parts of that statute that confirm that the General Assembly did not intend for the eminent domain procedures set forth to be jurisdictional, at least in the way that my friend on the other side suggests. I point the court to Revised Code 163.52, where it says failure to comply with Revised Code Chapter 163.59 doesn't affect the validity of an eminent domain proceeding. I point the court to 163.12c, where it says the court may amend any defect or informality in an appropriation proceeding. And so I think combined with the fact that jurisdiction is a much more narrow concept, and then also the General Assembly contemplated in statute that errors in invoking the eminent domain process are not fatal to a eminent domain proceeding.
So what is the remedy if the state didn't comply, didn't make a good faith offer?
I think, Your Honor, at most you would have a remedy, say you would have to make a new offer, but that really, your question of remedy goes also to a question of harm. And we've never heard from the Country Club in any of these proceedings how they are harmed by their allegation that the offer should have been different. They've never asserted that they would have accepted a higher offer. And for all the talk about the efforts to resolve cases like this and without resorting to eminent domain, the purpose of Revised Code 163.59, the History Connection has gone above and beyond in an attempt to reach a negotiated resolution. They made offers.
So are you saying that they have a burden to demonstrate that they were prejudiced by the state's, assuming the state failed to make a good faith offer? Are you saying they have the burden of demonstrating they were prejudiced by that?
I think so. I think a harmless error analysis is appropriate. And
that would be your burden then.
Well, and we have asserted that nothing about the offer here has prejudiced them. And I think there's certainly nothing in the record to support anything that would show prejudice. But regardless, we don't think that their legal test is right. We think that the History Connection did everything it was required to under statute and more. Under Revised Code 163.01J, Justice Fisher, you had asked about the definition of good faith. It defines good faith as the offer that must be made under 163.04B.
Isn't that kind of a circular definition?
I admit, Your Honor, it appears so on the surface. But if you look to what 163.04B actually says, it says you must make an offer based on an appraisal. Your good faith offer must be based on appraisal. The appraisal must be attached to your offer, and it must be provided at least 30 days prior to initiating eminent domain proceedings. And so I think it does seem circular on the surface, but when you look at what 163.04 actually says, it sets out a process. And then 163.041 has a form that you puts into practice what the requirements of 0.04 actually are. And so we think that if you follow the requirements of 0.04, if your offer is in the form prescribed by 0.041, that is a per se offer of good faith. And the courts that have considered this question, City of Wadsworth and Lawnfield Properties, they considered the statute both before it was amended to include an addition of the language of good faith and after it was amended. And both of those cases hold that if an offer is made for fair market value, that is a good faith offer. And we think that is all the statute requires.
Counsel, presuming you get in on the good faith, presuming the offer will get you the attention of the court, let's just say, let's address what the alternatives could have been or should have been or are available to preclude the taking, in other words, the necessity.
Absolutely, Your Honor. And we think that the court can affirm the necessity question for at least three reasons. One, based on statute, two, based on the country club's answer, and three, based on the factual findings made by the trial court, which would be reviewed for an abuse of discretion. I'll begin with the statute. Revised Code 163.01H2 states that a public park is a per se public use, and 163.09B1A states that when an acquiring agency passes a resolution declaring a necessity, they are entitled to a presumption of that necessity. And
well, counsel, what about the authority to even create a public park?
I don't understand that to be properly preserved as a question, but even if it is, there's at least two relevant statutes. Revised Code 1743.07 gives the history connection the power to acquire property through eminent domain, specifically refers to earthworks and any prehistoric mound. And Revised Code 149.30, which sets out the duties of the history connection, which are to acquire and maintain earthworks. And so it is undisputed that the history connection has the power to acquire property. In fact, they already own the property here. We're only talking about a leasehold interest. All that the country club is entitled to is operate a golf course. But putting that aside, certainly there is statutory authority to have property of this type. And if you look to what the history connection does, they operate parks throughout the state. They operate historic sites. And so I don't think there can be any dispute that of the authority to operate a park on this property consistent with what the history connection does on a day-to-day basis already. In fact, there is another park, the Great Circle, that is just down the road, and no one has disputed that the history connection has the authority to operate that park. But going back to the necessity question, Mr. Fraley, I understand, has relied on Norwood and says, well, Norwood supports their argument. It actually does the exact opposite. Imagine if the shoe was on the other foot. Imagine if it was the state standing before you and said, we need to acquire property, private property, so that we can create a private country club. And this is a public use that we can use our eminent domain power because of all these economic benefits that would flow from it. This court would rightfully reject that on the basis of Norwood. Norwood said that private benefits don't rise to the level of public use in terms of taking. And so Mr. Fraley's argument is clearly and straightforwardly precluded by Norwood. But you don't even need to get there because, as I said, first, the statute revised code 163.09B1A entitles the history connection to a presumption of necessity. If they adopt a resolution declaring the necessity, that resolution is in the record at Exhibit 11. It declares.
Counsel, I believe the country club's brief made the argument that there could have been, I'll use the word compromise. In other words, there could have been alternatives that could have maybe accomplished what the Ohio History Connection wanted, which would be some sort of public access to the mounds. And then the country club's purpose, is that required, that kind of a negotiation?
It is not, Your Honor. That argument is wrong as a legal matter, and it's wrong as a factual matter. As a legal matter, this court and no court has ever held that absolute necessity is required. In eminent domain proceedings, it is considered to be just a necessity requirement is reasonably convenient to the public use. And that goes back to the beginning of the adoption of Revised Code Chapter 163. And that would open the door to someone who says, well, we want to expand the road. And if their absolute necessity argument was appropriate, then someone could say, well, you shouldn't expand the road. You should build a commuter rail. You should buy a new bus. And so the court is adopting a rule here that is going to govern every Revised Code Chapter 163 appropriation proceeding. And so it's unworkable as a legal matter, but it's also wrong as a factual matter. Justice Bruner, you had asked before about abuse of discretion and factual determinations. Here there was ample testimony that the country club's proposed sharing of the property doesn't counteract the necessity. And if you look at footnote 13 of the trial court's opinion, it said no matter who bears the burden of necessity, whether you rely on the presumption in 163.09, whether you don't, that the history connection had more than carried its burden of showing that this appropriation was necessary for the creation of a public park. And so I also want to go back briefly and to the good faith question, because that same abuse of discretion standard applies even if you do not agree with our statutory presumption.
Okay. I'm trying to understand your good faith argument a little bit. Essentially, it seems to be as long as it's based on an appraisal, as long as an offer is based on an appraisal, it's in good faith. So, I mean, could an agency go out and get 50 appraisals till they found one they liked?
They could, Your Honor, but there are reasons why that is unlikely to occur, and there's reasons why agencies would not want to do that. As long as an agency,
but suppose they got 10. I mean, they can just shop around until they find an appraisal that they like, and that's the only one they have to disclose. That doesn't seem like good faith.
I think it is, Your Honor, because what the question is an offer being made for fair market value? And as long as a qualified appraisal, and remember, appraisers are regulated entities, they are licensed. And so appraisers answer to a higher body. And so an appraiser is not going to go out and do a bad job because their license is on the line. So as long as you have a qualified appraisal saying this is fair market value, then I think that is still a good faith offer. And let me tell you
we see tax cases all the time, and you see a qualified appraisers that come to broad ranges of value. So, I mean, that it's hard to say, you know, when you have appraisals that are, one's twice as much as the other, they both can't be fair market value.
I mean, you're right. They both can't be
responsibility on the agency at that point.
Several answers. If you give me a moment, I'll try to work through them in the most succinct manner. First, yes, you're right. They all can't be fair market value, but that's why we have a valuation proceeding, and that's why those are presented to a jury. Now, your question of could they choose which to rely on? They can, and there are reasons why they may not want to do what you suggest, and why, as a practical matter, that's not actually a concern. And then also why that's not an issue in this case. It's not a concern because no matter what appraisal an agency uses, they're going to have to defend that appraisal at an appropriation proceeding. And so if you get 10 appraisals and 9 of them are high and one is an outlier and it's low, and you choose to rely on the outlier, well, you're taking a risk there that you're not going to be able to defend that in an appropriation proceeding. And there's bite to that. If you choose a lowball appraisal, the revised code chapter 163.21C says, and if the jury awards a significantly higher amount, you're on the hook for attorney's fees and for costs. And so, yes, an agency can go get multiple appraisals, but if they lowball an offer, they're going to have to pay much more than just the property, the interest that they're acquiring. They're also gonna have to pay fees and costs. And so there's an incentive built in to say, don't go around and try to lowball someone. Offer a fair market value. Otherwise, you're going to be on the hook for this additional expense. And so we would say that there's no rule, there's nothing in law that precludes multiple appraisals, but there are practical consequences and there are things that will prevent that sort of worst case scenario as you posit.
But here, if we accept your argument at face value, what I think you're saying to me is good faith equals in the statute, in an eminent domain case, as long as they had a qualified fair market value report from an appraiser. But here you actually have an individual who says, I'm not an expert. I'm not an appraiser. I didn't know what I was looking at. And instead of asking someone to get advice, he just chooses one to go with, and one is higher. So how is that good faith in the individual or due diligence by the person who's handling this on behalf of the seeker for eminent domain?
Two responses, Your Honor. First, that's a factual question that was resolved in favor of the history connection by the courts below, and we think that should be reviewed for an abuse of discretion. But even so, even if you were reviewing it de novo, that one, there were two appraisals here, both were conducted by qualified appraisals. Only one of them valued the interest to be acquired. The Kuhn appraisal is the only one that provided a value of the leasehold interest. The Weiler appraisal valued two separate things. It valued the fee simple, and it valued the fee as encumbered by the lease. And so when the History Connection, yes, they made a mistake about what the Weiler appraisal was valuing, but when they made that mistake, they actually offered what they thought was the higher amount. And so if you want to talk about good faith, in faced with two appraisals, they thought they were making the higher appropriation. And you have the trial court looked at the appraisals and said, not only is the testimony persuasive that you were acting in good faith, I, the trial court, looked at these and I also found the one confusing. And finally, I would point out that the country club wants to do some math and calculation, say, well, if you subtract one thing from the other in this Weiler appraisal, you'll see that the value is actually higher. Well, you can't do that. Among other things, if you look at Exhibit 44, it's the Weiler appraisal, and it's page 2, numbered page 2, page 8 of the PDF. There's actually a disclaimer in there that says you can only use this appraisal for what it says it's for. You can't use the information in this appraisal to calculate the value of anything other than this specific amount.
I don't want to cut you off, but I really do want to get into one more question, and that's the de novo review that the appellant says that the appeals court should have performed. I didn't see very much at all on the part of the trial court in interpreting statutes. What kind of de novo review could the appellate court have done based on what's in the trial court record?
I don't think de novo review would have been appropriate at all. In the trial court record, just to give you a sense of what's in there, if that answers the question, feel free to follow up. There's testimony from several representatives of the History Connection. There's testimony from representatives of the National Park Service. There's exhibits, including the appraisals, the declaration of necessity from the board of the History Connection. We don't think that de novo review is appropriate because we think that if certainly the factual findings that were made by the trial court are correct, subject to abuse of discretion, and there was no abuse of discretion. We think the legal standards they applied, certainly with respect to necessity, are correct. And if anything, like we said, the question of good faith, we think, is a bright line rule, or at least a statutory presumption, that as long as you make an offer for fair market value as determined by a qualified appraisal, that is good faith. It may not be that a jury agrees, but that is certainly meets the threshold statute. Because remember where this fits in the whole context of Revised Code Chapter 163. The good faith offer is just the beginning of a process. And if you have the type of inquiry the country club suggests at the beginning of every process, you're going to extend every eminent domain proceeding. You're going to have essentially a double valuation hearing. That's not what it was intended to do. It was intended to kick off the process, say, this is what we think it's worth, begin a negotiation. Negotiations had been ongoing with the country club for quite some time. And in fact, the History Connection had obtained two appraisals prior to the ones that are at issue here. And so the country club can't even say that they were surprised by these appraisals, because if you look at Exhibit 44, which is a letter that accompanied the Weiler appraisal when we sent it to the country club as soon as they asked, it notes that two appraisals were already done at the country club's request. And so here we would think that the court below applied the proper standard. We made a good faith offer based on an appraised value conducted by a qualified appraisal. We think that necessity was clearly established both in statute and as a factual matter, so factual and legal, and that the courts below correctly determined both questions. And we would ask this court to affirm, remand, so a jury can determine the appropriate valuation and what compensation is due to the country club.
Thank you. Mr. Fraley, you've used your time. You may take a minute. You have to unmute yourself, sir.
I would like to start at the beginning. Thank you very much. Opposing counsel has indicated that how were we harmed? They didn't take the higher number. They wouldn't have accepted the higher appraisal. Those facts aren't in evidence, but I submit to you, if you start off any relationship, legal or otherwise, and you don't disclose a pertinent material fact, i.e. the Weiler appraisal, how is it that any trust would be had within that party? And is that appropriate in the context of 163.59 to avoid litigation, how would we have known if litigation was not ensued that there was another appraisal?
Okay. Assume we agree with you and we say, okay, they didn't initiate this process properly. You've got to start all over. So they come back, they offer you $1.75 million. Don't we just end up back in the same place? You say no. And is anything different than it is today?
Well, here's what would be different. Number one, if they complied with the statute to inform us that there was an appraisal, allow us to accompany that appraisal, that's part of it. Now, the other part is we would assume that
we dismiss the case and they start again. What will be different?
Here's what might be different as it applies to 16359. If there is an appraisal, one, and they submit it to us.
We know they have two appraisals, right? So,
correct.
Yeah, just my question is, if we dismiss this case and they start over and offer you $1.75 million, how is that, what's going to change?
Well, what would change at least at that stage is hopefully, as happened in the first case, the well was poisoned. Once we found that second appraisal was out there and I myself found it,
the well is already poisoned. So what's going to be different if we dismiss this case and they start over besides delay?
Well, I think in our specific case, we start with a clean slate, start with everybody knowing what the appraisals are. That's number one. Now, I think further for all landowners that come after us.
Again, it would be helpful if you could just answer the question of what's going to change here in this case. I mean, you had the litigation history. You know what the appraisals are. I presume that they offered you $1.75 million. Your client would say no. So what changes if we dismiss the case and they start over, other than delay?
Well, the jurisdictional issue for one. If they act in good faith, which an appraisal. And they give it.
Okay. Well, I just told you they've got the appraisal. The scenario is they make you an offer based on the highest appraisal. So
at that point, my clients would have the opportunity to review the appraisal to see if it was appropriate, compare it to the appraisal they've already received.
But isn't that stuff they've already done?
We have never gotten the offer of the Weiler appraisal, though.
You've seen the Weiler appraisal. I think they've made you an offer in that amount, haven't they?
Right. They have not. They have not done that.
So the heart of this question is it going to make a difference? Well, are your clients going to really look at that other number and there's an opportunity to resolve the case?
Well, it may not make a difference. Of course, that would depend upon the appraisal and the behavior of the, if they're after that, I were to find that there was yet another appraisal out there, it may not change.
Counsel, then why not just go to the jury and let's figure out what it's worth? I mean, that's the bottom line here. If you're saying you're dancing around the question and not really answering it, you're saying what I'm hearing is, I don't know what we would accept. And if that's the case, are you negotiating in good faith here?
Well, I'd like to certainly think I have, as I've handled it from the beginning. And what I would state to the court on that is very simply, if this started out with a good faith offer, now I realize now the well's been poisoned. That was no fault of ours. That was theirs. They should bear that burden, not my clients. But let's take it to the logical conclusion. If a good faith offer is submitted, then it gives us every right that statute implies, that we can accept it, we can reject it, we can do all the things that the statute allows us to do.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Gentlemen, we'll take the matter under advisement. You'll be notified of our decision.
Thank you.